Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Joshua Foa Dienstag, and he is the author of Cinema Pessimism, a political theory of representation and reciprocity. This was published in 2020 by Oxford University Press, and Joshua is a scholar of aesthetics, political theory, film in particular, and he is very wise. I learned much from reading this book. But I'd like Joshua to tell us a little bit about it as we move into this conversation. Joshua, first, I'd like to welcome you to the New Books podcast and ask you to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to this particular project.
Hi, Lily. It's great to be here. Thank you so much for asking me to do this. I think of myself, initially as a historian of political theory, and I've written a lot about political theory, for example, of the American founders, and about the tradition of pessimism in European political theory. And when I finished that book on pessimism, I thought I would do something completely different, which was teach and learn a little bit about film, which had always been something I was fascinated by, but I didn't actually think it was going to be an intellectual focus. But I taught a class, and then I started writing some papers that eventually became different chapters of this book, mostly to try to figure out what, if anything, we could learn from film about politics. There is certainly a long tradition of people who study film and political theory. And recently, there's been a lot of interest in the general topic of representation in democracy, and a group of theorists writing about the value of representative democracy. And I thought that film kind of gave us an important perspective on that literature. As it turns out, a more pessimistic perspective on that literature. So that's sort of how the project got generated. And then it just came together over a couple of years as I sort of found the themes that unified what I'd been writing about in these different papers.
And the themes that you sort of talk about through this book, and you just mentioned sort of the structure of thinking, I think, is the way that I was understanding it as I read through the book, mm-hmm. is this question of representative democracy. And you trace, you know, you sort of trace quickly at the beginning of the book as sort of an understanding of how a lot of us in political theory, but in general, think about representative democracy. We live in one.
Yes.
And yet there's, again, there's this sort of tension, as I always have with my students, talking to them about democracy. We are not in a direct democracy. Yes. And you sort of talk about that in context of thinking about why we should be interested also in film.
Yes.
So can you talk about that?
Sure. Right. Well, so there is a long history of, I guess I'd say, the romance of direct democracy. We talk about democracy often, as if the ideal kind of democracy is the direct Athenian democracy, where, you know, everyone's a legislator, everyone's a voter, everyone's a potential speaker, there's only one assembly, and we're all in it. Of course, that kind of democracy has hardly ever existed in the history of the world, and certainly has never existed in this country. But the result of that romance is that we talk about representation as a kind of second best democracy, something that we have to be careful about, because we don't participate directly. We have representatives who do most of the legislating, and then, you know, we participate just sporadically when we vote or in other ways. So traditionally, there's been a lot of skepticism about representative democracy. Recently, however, there's been a movement in the world of political theory, a very interesting movement, to defend representative democracy as the better kind of democracy, in fact, on the grounds that it's better capable of producing, say, reasoned, deliberative decision making, or informed decision making, or something like that, on the reasonably plausible grounds that it's hard for 200 million people to have a conversation, or 300 million people to have a conversation about anything. And so we should, think of representative democracy as a place of informed decision making, or something like that. And although I find this literature very interesting, I remain skeptical, mostly because this kind of representative democracy can create inequality, political inequality, not just the kind of inequality of rich and poor, but the inequality between those who speak and those who are silent, that I think is that mirrors in a way what we experience in cinema, which is a very powerful emotional experience, an experience of emotional connection, but also a passive or disempowering experience. So cinema is important in part because it, you know, teaches us how powerful an experience representation is, even for those who aren't directly participating in it. And the sort of central concern of the book is how do we manage that relationship? Because I, you know, agree very much that we can't really go back to direct democracy. It's impossible if we want to have, you know, even a medium-sized state. We could break up the United States into, you know, 300 separate polities, and there would still be a million people, and you can't have a conversation with a million people. But representation has kind of dangers built into it, and we're not always completely aware of those dangers.
And I wanted to ask you about what those dangers are in terms of the political, of the understanding of politics, but also where they all thread into the question of cinema.
Well, there are a couple of dangers. One is that just the representative relationship crowds out every other kind of human relationship, and makes us in a way worse people. And a simplified way to think about this is just in the way that the more time we spend staring at our screens, the less time we spend actually talking to other people. But the images and emotions and interactions that we have with the screens can be so powerful that we don't always sort of notice what's going on. And that's what goes on in the film Her, which is a wonderful film that came out a few years ago with Joaquin Phoenix about, you know, the man who falls in love with his operating system, his computer operating artificial intelligence system, which, you know, mimics human personality so perfectly that, you know, it's just the best thing that's ever happened to him. But the point of the film is that in the end, these relationships can't replace or shouldn't replace the actual friendships and family relationships that we have with other real live people. But we can become swept up in them. And just because they're so easy and they do give us a kind of emotional satisfaction, just in the way film and television can give us a kind of emotional satisfaction without actually entering us into a real relationship of equals. So just for those reasons, representation can, you know, substitute for real human relationships without us knowing or without us noticing very much, to the point that we end up isolated as human beings. And in a way I try to explain in the book, you know, less human just because we're not engaging in any real relationships of equals with other people. And that's very dangerous because the fabric of our human society depends upon those relationships. And it's not, I think, just a fantasy that we could lose that human fabric in our society. I think it's really happening, between television, cinema, and the internet, and video games and, you know, every other kind of interaction we have. Being with other human beings is comparatively speaking difficult, and it's easy for us to escape. And we have more avenues of escape now than ever. And we have to be careful about using them.
And the idea of the isolation and the escape is not necessarily new. Obviously, this is something that Tocqueville warned against 130 years ago. That I talk to my students about, but you're talking about sort of the sort of built-in difficulty that representation as a political dynamic, as a form of democracy, has always had embedded in it. Is that correct? And so that danger is always there if we live in a representative democracy. And how is that? To some degree, is that more pronounced now in terms of politics, separate from the evaluation of the role of film or cinema?
Yeah, I mean, what I'd say is you're right that the danger has always been there. I mean, first of all, the thing to say about it is that the relationship between the population and the representative is an emotional relationship. It's not just an intellectual or a material relationship. It's not just that we send our representative a bunch of ideas and the representative sifts through them. And it's not just that we think of the representative as a transmitter of our interests. There's always been an emotional connection between representative and population, sometimes stronger, sometimes weaker, sometimes more positive, sometimes less positive. But I think what has changed as our state has grown is that, you know, at the time of the Constitutional Convention or when de Tocqueville was writing, it was approximately, for example, 50,000 citizens to U.S. House representative. So that meant that your representative was someone who, you know, maybe wasn't a friend, but someone that you knew or someone who was a friend of a friend. 50,000 people is about the number of people that are on campus on UCLA, where I teach, every day. But now it's nearly 900,000 citizens to House representative. That's a much bigger ratio. And the distance between an individual citizen and the person speaking on their behalf in our national system of government, and also in state and local, has just increased dramatically. And so whereas before you might have had, you know, this emotional relationship alongside, you know, a more direct intellectual or personal or material connection to your representative. Now our representatives are more like the people that we interact with, if you can call it interaction, in film and television, where we have, you know, a relatively distant
It's not very human.
I mean, it remains human in the emotional sense that, you know, we emotionally invest in characters and we get something back from them in terms of emotion. But what we don't have is anything like reciprocity. You know, we do sort of have the illusion of reciprocity. We have, you know, what feels like a powerful connection. You know, we incessantly talk about the shows and characters in television and movies that we're engaged with because they do engage us emotionally, but it's not anything like true reciprocity, which only comes with, you know, a genuine back and forth with another person.
And that sort of mirrors, that's what you're sort of talking about in the book, is that this is mirrored by our sort of disconnection to our elected officials. And that we have these kind of distant and disconnected relationships with our representatives. You can like go on their website and fill in a box and somebody will get back to you who's speaking on their behalf. But again, you're not really in any kind of interaction. And you know this from living in the state of California. You have two senators who represent close to 40 million people. And you know the folks in the great state of Wyoming have two senators who represent less than 700,000 people. And so in the larger spaces also, this is even more, potentially more disconnected at the federal level. There may be more relationship at the local and state level.
And the ironic thing is that, you know, at one level there is a lot of information that goes back and forth, and in a way more information goes back and forth now than in the 1800s or 1700s. I can email my representative. I can text them. And there's a lot of polling that they do and opinion surveys. So, you know, they know a lot about me and I can transmit things to them. And I, you know, I probably will get some kind of response back to my email, but not from the person themselves. So, you know, I think this is one of the reasons why defenders of representative democracy will say, look how much information is going back and forth. Look how well positioned they are to understand what your needs are. And that is true. But at the same time, there's an inequality and an emotional distortion that's taking place that is worse than 100 or 200 or 300 years ago. And that's a dangerous situation.
And the emotional distortion is also what you are exploring with regard to the cinematic representations in the book. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, again, you have the example of the movie Her, but you have a number of other films or that you are looking at that sort of you're getting at or digging into this question of that emotional distortion in the relationship?
Yeah. Well, this part of the argument does pick up on something that Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote hundreds of years ago about the theater. He was, as he says in his book about the theater, he was a great fan of the theater and a great critic at the same time. He said he'd never willingly missed a production of Molière. But he also said that theater was bad for a Republican government, and he opposed the opening of a theater in his native Geneva, where there was no theater at the time. And what he said about it was that it is precisely this question of the emotional relationship between the actor and the audience. The audience, he says, you know, goes to the theater to be with other people, but in fact, they're all alone. And what he meant by that is, you know, obviously he didn't mean that they're physically all alone, because you are with other people in a theater or at the movies. But you're alone in the sense that the effect of the performance is to isolate you emotionally. You're there with other people, but you're not actually talking to them. You're not actually interacting with them. You feel like you're interacting with a person who is on stage. The thrill of the theater is precisely the emotional charge that you get from it. It's not a lecture. You don't go to receive information. You go to experience a passion of love or fear if you go to see a horror movie. And you go precisely because these emotions are more powerful in the theater than they are somewhere else. And it feels like you're in a kind of relationship with the person who's on the screen. You're not just witnessing people falling in love. You're kind of going through the motions with them. You're not just witnessing people being afraid. You're going through the emotions with them. So it feels like you're in a relationship, but you're not. And in fact, you only become sort of further, or, you know, potentially, you don't get closer to any other human being while you're at the theater, but it feels like you do. Rousseau's concern was that this didn't strengthen your connection to other citizens, even though you were there with other people. It actually weakened them. I think that argument has a great deal of validity and applies in even stronger terms to cinema, to the internet, to all of these interactions where our emotions are engaged, and it feels like we're in a relationship, or it feels like we're creating a bond with others, but we're just not. And the reason that we're not is the lack of reciprocity. Real relationships involve, an exchange of something between two people, whether it's friendship or love or family. Or political community. All of those, and they're all different from one another, but they all do have that reciprocal character, where it's the give and take between the parties that make up the relationship. But it is easy to kind of simulate that that feeling of emotional exchange, and it's easier to be on the receiving end without having to do anything. And when you go to the theater, or when you go to the movies, you don't really have to do anything. You just get to sit there and enjoy the relationship without doing any of the work.
That was one of the critiques early on from the Frankfurt School, was the passivity of the experience. And so this continues to be a concern in terms of the fact that you are having an emotional experience, but it is in a passive capacity, and it is to some degree solitary, even if you are in a theater with many people.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how that is also potentially problematic in context of our understanding of representative democracy?
Well, yes. I mean, just in the sense that if representative democracy is to do its job, it has to do its job by, you know, advancing the interests and needs of the democratic population as a whole. But it can't do that if that population is disempowered, and if people don't participate actively in their own governance, then then representative democracy fails its mission. If the very form of representation even as it's transmitting information, has the effect of disempowering the population, then it can't be a good thing. Now, that doesn't mean that direct democracy is workable either, but what it means is that we have to consider how best to organize representation so that it doesn't disempower the very people that it's supposed to empower. And as I talk about later on in the book, I do think there are avenues for doing that. There are forms of representation that don't have this disempowering effect, but they're less fun. They may be less emotionally satisfying, and they may be more work for everybody, which is to say that, you know, what's fun and what actually makes for freedom in a democratic community aren't the same thing.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so before we get there, if I could talk to you a little bit about this concept also that's embedded in the title and that you sort of talk about in your book in terms of understanding pessimism from the perspective that you are coming at it. In context of not only your own interpretation or understanding of it, but also how we should think about it in terms of both politics and cinema.
Well, I mean, pessimism to me doesn't mean that, you know, everything's going to hell in a handbasket or that there's no hope. It just means that there are irreducible tensions between different goods and especially between freedom and happiness. The things that make us free and the things that make us happy aren't the same. There's a trade-off, and we have to be very careful about how we choose. And optimism is the belief that there's no trade-off, that we can be perfectly free and perfectly happy at the same time, that there's no cost to maintaining free institutions. And I, you know, I don't think that's true. I do think that is what, you know, a tradition of political theorists like Rousseau and like de Tocqueville were trying to tell us. But we don't have to read the old books, although it's a very good idea to read them. We can also see it in the institutions all around us.
And so I wanted to ask you to take us through some of the sort of cinematic artifacts that you integrated beyond the film Her. You also take us through the Up series, which you cast as a series of films, but it was originally on television, and it also is an import from the UK, and Blade Runner. So can you walk us through, to some degree, why these particular artifacts are contributing to the argument that you're making?
Yeah. Well, let me talk about another film that you didn't mention first, which is The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which is a great Western from John Ford. That is exactly about, to me, the trade-off between freedom and happiness. And what happens in it is that Jimmy Stewart comes to a town that's in a Western territory that's dominated by a dangerous gunslinger who's named Liberty Valance, and has to transform itself into a place that's peaceful and harmonious, and it wants to be integrated into the United States. That is, the territory wants statehood, and this is the metaphor in the film for, you know, transformation from a lawless state of nature to a well-ordered state. And at first, Jimmy Stewart sort of thinks that it's no problem, that we're all going to be free and happy. All we have to do is get together and vote, talk about what we want, and, you know, the problems will go away. And what he learns in the course of the film, what we all learn, is no, there's a price that has to be paid. And the price in this case is that someone actually has to kill Liberty Valance. That is, someone has to murder him. Because there's no lawful state to do it for us, or to, you know, to put him in jail or something like that. And in the course of the film, what's shown is that it actually takes, first of all, more than one person. It's not just Jimmy Stewart who does all this, although he gets the credit for it in the end. And the story of the film is that there is a path to freedom. But there's a price to be paid, and the price is paid by the character of Jimmy Stewart, who's, you know, transformed into a not bitter, but rather unhappy man, just because he sort of carries through the duty of, you know, taking on the burden of these sins, in order for other people to enjoy the prospect of prosperity and freedom. So that's, you know, that's to me the embodiment of the pessimism that I'm talking about. Like, you know, we can organize ourselves in a free and lawful society, but we won't all be happy in this process. And we can't imagine that it's easy. So that, you know, so I use that film to talk about the sort of the costs of a free and well-ordered society. But in when the Up series of films, which is what I focus on in the last chapter, is meant to talk about the value of representation. There is a way in which we can think of representation as working. But it's not in the way that Hollywood movies normally work. The Up series isn't a romantic comedy. It's a documentary about actual people, a group of English people who've been filmed every 7 years for 50 years. And it's a wonderful documentary series. And it does show these people in a way that no other form of representation can. That is, it's a successful representation in the sense that you really get a wonderful portrait of these people, but it's not a portrait that makes them happy. They're not they don't love it, even though it's just the, you know, the there's nothing else like it. 50 years of film, it's incredible. There's no other people you can know on this earth as well, considering that you've never met them. And it does show things about them that they can't know about themselves. When you look back over 50 years of film, you see things that, you know, even the people themselves aren't in a position to see, just as a, you know, a biographer can know things about you that you yourself aren't in a great position to know, because the biographer can look back over your whole life. Whereas you are always, you know, stuck in the present. And that is a positive function that representation can perform. That is, rather than giving us, you know, what we want in each instant, representation and film representation even can, you know, give us the whole person. If you think about the whole person as something that appears across time and not just in any moment. So that's, you know, so that's the good and the bad of film and representation in general, and what they can do for democracy. That there is, I think, an important role for representation in democracy, but it has to be kind of handled with care so that the dangers don't overwhelm the positives.
And so in specifically in The Blade Runner, which I think I heard you give that paper some years back. Again, the science fiction is always an area where sort of politics can get hashed out a little bit because it's such an imaginary space. What is it specifically, because you talk about Blade Runner also in providing an interesting kind of self-referential understanding of maybe what it's doing.
Right. Well, Blade Runner, you know, an amazing film on a number of dimensions, powerful film. I hope some of the people listening to this will have seen Blade Runner. And for those who can remember it, the film itself is obsessed with eyes. You know, it starts with this famous image of an eye looking out over Los Angeles, and the camera cuts back and forth to Los Angeles and the eye. And there's a whole bunch of stuff with eyes throughout the film. They go see the androids go see the maker of eyes, and there are a bunch of scenes that have to do with eyes. And what this is all about is that the film itself is in a sense self-referential. In a sense, you can understand it as about the experience of film going or film viewing, in the sense that In Blade Runner, human beings meet images who look and sound like them that they interact with, which is a little bit like what happens when we go to the movies and we see something that looks like a human being, that sounds like a human being, and that creates an emotional connection as with a human being, but ultimately which isn't a human being. And the difficulty in the film is that the humans and the androids not just don't get along, but don't understand, at least initially, the similarities and the differences. So that the human beings treat the replicants like slaves. They just order them around, which is a little bit like what we do with our internet and filmed images. The movies are just, you know, there for our pleasure and satisfaction, in the same way that the replicants are just there for the pleasure and satisfaction of the humans. And it's not until one human being, you know, Deckard, Harrison Ford, comes to understand that there's a possibility of real reciprocity with the replicants, and likewise, one of the replicants, Rachel, comes to the point where she can interact with Harrison Ford as an equal. What happens in the film is that, you know, out of these two groups of people who can't interact with one another, you find two individuals who can. And so there, what I think the film is telling us is that their relationship is a model of equality, precisely because they respect one another as individuals and interact with one another as individuals. The other replicants want to be free, but they don't want to respect the human beings. They think of themselves as superior, and the other human beings don't want to respect the replicants. But at the end of the film, when the one human and the one replicant who can interact as equals come to accept one another as equals, what they do is shut the door and run away, because they don't want to be in a film anymore. They don't want to be in a story anymore. Their relationship isn't there for our consumption. And so we don't actually see them have the relationship. We just see them leave, because it's not there for our consumption. Just in the way that, you know, you wouldn't really be happy if your most intimate moments of interaction with other human beings were displayed on film for everyone to see. That's not what they're for. Not every, you know, reciprocal relationship is, you know, intimate and romantic, but there is a way in which that reciprocity and equality between human beings is sort of fragile and precious, and it you know, needs to be handled with care, and it doesn't necessarily withstand exposure to millions of eyes. So Blade Runner is sort of a, you know, to me, a giant metaphor for, you know, going to the movies and then leaving the movies in pursuit of a better and more equal and reciprocal human relationship with other people.
And I wanted to ask you this because you sort of nod at it in a lot of the discussion in the book. It's also... you know, one of the things about having your emotions sort of keyed up in these experiences in a dark theater, and you know, you're like, what do we do with that afterwards? How much of these films, either the ones you talk about or other ones that we experience, what parts stay with us, and why, and how is that important to our thinking about this question of our role in a representative democracy?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. I mean, one of my concerns is just that the powerful emotional experience in the theater ends up crowding out kind of everyday life. You know, we go back to it. We become addicted to our screens. You know, according to statistics, we now spend, I don't know, 6 to 8 hours a day staring at screens one way or another. Of course, it's not all emotional relationships, but it has the effect of making our ordinary human relationships seem pale and difficult by comparison. So what I'm worried we take out of it into the real world is a kind of heightened dissatisfaction with what are the very real difficulties of ordinary human relationships. But, you know, oh, I'd rather not have that meeting. I'd rather not have that talk. I'd rather just watch my shows. Ultimately is very debilitating for democracy. Democracy is full of difficult conversations. There's no question about it. It's hard to talk to your friends about politics. You know, what if you disagree about things? That could be threatening, and it is threatening. But if we don't have those conversations, we'll never get anywhere. We'll just each of us be more isolated and more willing to let someone else make decisions for us, or have decision making be made somewhere far away.
The passive voice.
Yes, it's so the it is difficult to govern a country with hundreds of millions of people in it. There are all kinds of pressures to depoliticize the community at large. That was, as you said, a concern of the Frankfurt School. I think it was also a concern before that in theorists like Rousseau and de Tocqueville, politics was a difficult business and people didn't like to do it. It is, after all, an experiment to have politics be conducted by the entire community. It's really only in the 20th century that, you know, women have been able to participate. Racial minorities have been able to participate. It's not as if we've ever had a fully democratic community. Of course, in ancient Greece, it was just a tiny fraction of the population that was allowed to attend the assembly. So it is still an experiment to see whether democracy can work on a large scale, and surely representation is going to play some role in making that experiment go. But there is also the danger that we will run away from the difficulties of participation because they are genuinely hard. And accept an emotional substitute, or something that feels like reciprocity but isn't. And that's what I think we get, not just in the movies, but in interactions with artificial intelligence,
video games,
right. All those things give us emotional satisfaction without requiring that we ourselves give anything back.
And of course the endorphins that apparently spike when people like your things on Facebook.
Yes, it's true.
I understand. So you also engage with Lars von Trier's work. Yeah. And I know he is popular among political theorists.
It's true.
And so can you talk about why his work in particular is also part of your broader sort of cinema pessimism?
Yes. This is a slightly different issue. I do write in the book about the film Melancholia, and also an earlier film of his called Zentropa. Melancholia is a film about the end of the world, the destruction of the world, and why it might be, from his perspective, maybe a good thing. The easiest way to say it is that Lars von Trier makes films about evil. About the evil that lurks within all of us, in every person and in every community. And some of his films are about, you know, Nazism, and a lot of his films are about death. I think the value of these films is just in confronting the evil that's within every community. And that means, therefore, if we're thinking about, you know, what is good representation, what does it mean for a people to be represented politically? Well, do we ignore the evil, or pretend it doesn't exist, or imagine that somehow through representation we can purify a community so that the representation, the evil goes away or is invisible? I think he has in mind, among other things, criticizing, you know, Hollywood films where, everyone's good looking, everyone's nice in the end, and love always wins and freedom always wins. Not every Hollywood film, of course, conforms to this stereotype, but certainly a lot of them do. A lot of the reasons for the popularity of many kinds of popular art is the fact that they're a sanitized version of the world as it really is. But if we're really serious about representation as a means of democratic self-governance, well, it doesn't do to pretend that evil doesn't play a part in our world. And not just as something that we can exclude by, you know, finding the bad person to exclude. Nazism didn't come about just because Hitler was an evil person, but because millions of people responded to that evil and participated in it. Whatever dangers lurk in our own political community, they're real dangers, not because there's a few bad people around, but because all of us contain within ourselves, to some degree, violent and powerful and dangerous emotions, hatreds and vices. And that's also part of what it means to be a human being. But it's very hard to deal with. Very hard to look at clearly. And that's part of what I think von Trier's films try to do, not always perfectly successfully, but that I think is the point of them. And I think any theory of democracy and any theory of democratic representation has to come to grips with this. And it's very hard to do. I don't think prior theories of democratic representation have done this adequately, but you know, I don't. It's just something that's very hard to do, and this is the hard work of political theory, that I'm just in this book trying to hint at some of the problems, really, as much as offer solutions. It's not easy.
And you're also not only hinting at the problems, but you're also suggesting that there are problems that in our political system and that our sort of lives outside of those political systems also have a lot of the same dynamics going on that we may not really be aware of.
Yes. I mean, what part of the point I try to make in the book is that in order for a democratic system to be successful, you know, we need both a good system of representation and we need democratic lives outside the system of representation that are healthy, open, and free. So what's important for that are the conditions of equality and the condition of reciprocity, where we actually engage in open give and take with other individuals, you know, across a variety of institutions, the family, the workplace, the larger political community. All of these have to be, ideally, well-structured in order for representation not to, you know, drain the life out of daily political life. So, representation needs to be well-structured, but also the rest of our lives need to be well-structured too. That's, you know, we don't exist for the purpose of having good representation. Good representation exists for the purpose of helping us to be free and live our best lives, whatever that is.
I'm getting the sense from the book and from the conversation that the key component that we're not paying a lot of attention to is the question of reciprocity.
Yes.
In part because the reciprocity also has to toggles between our emotional and our rational selves.
Yes, that's true. But also the important point to me is that, you know, none of us live a fully human life by ourselves. Robinson Crusoe may not have anyone to interfere with his life, but he doesn't have anyone to participate in his life either. And I don't really think that we can live a complete human life by ourselves. We need a series of relationships, not just one other person, but people to be our friends, people to be our collaborators, people to be our coworkers, people to be our family members, and people to be our fellow citizens. I think these are all the components of a good human life, but they require equal and reciprocal relationships with other people. So, you can be as rich as you want, but if you're alone, you just don't have a full human life. And that is what we are in danger of losing, insofar as our life becomes more cinematic, that is, insofar as our life becomes more absorbed into unequal relationships that are mediated by a screen. So that to me is what we're in danger of losing, but we also need the image of what it is we want to retain. And it's not as if the movies or the internet went away that we would automatically revert to these happy, equal relationships. They're already difficult to sustain in the same way it's difficult to sustain friendships, relationships, work relationships. There are plenty of difficulties even apart from the interference by film or the internet or something like that. But at the same time, if we don't sustain them, we're like little Robinson Crusoes.
So the Black Mirror is both adding and subtracting simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can learn something from movies, even if we shouldn't lose ourselves in the movies.
And I totally get that. That, again, that makes a lot of sense in understanding our emotional relationship to the projected images, but also what do we do with the sort of emotions in our day-to-day lives?
Yeah.
And sort of working around them.
Absolutely.
So, Joshua, what are you working on now after this major contribution to understanding ourselves?
Thank you. I don't know how major it is, but thank you. So I've become interested in if cinema is one kind of distraction from equal human reciprocity, there are others. For example, our relationships with artificial intelligence, with animals, with the environment. I feel like in the 21st century, the boundaries of the human are being increasingly tested by both kind of biological and silicon-based substitutes for human beings. And I think that's only going to increase. So I'm trying to write a book about the boundaries of the human and why it's important to hang on to some kind of boundary between the human and the non-human world, even as our computers improve and our knowledge and understanding of the environment and animals improve. Those are all real developments and changes in the 21st century that, you know, our world's going to look a lot different at the end of this century than it did at the beginning. But I think it's important for us to hang on to what makes human relationships special, at least until true artificial intelligence appears.
And that's in Battlestar Galactica.
Yes.
Right? Exactly. That's what I thought.
Yes.
Cyborgs take over. Excellent. Okay. So when you finish that book, will you come on the New Books in Political Science podcast and talk to me about it?
Oh, I'd be so happy to do so. Thank you so much.
The cyborgs haven't taken over at that point.
Not yet.
All right. Excellent. Thank you, Joshua Foa Dienstag, for joining me today to talk about Cinema Pessimism, A Political Theory of Representation and Reciprocity. This is published by Oxford University Press in 2020. I assume one can pick up a copy of this at Oxford University Press website.
Yes.
And other online distributors, I'm sure.
Yes. Oxford Press, Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
All the big players.
Bookstores near you.
Okay, great. Thank you for joining me today, Joshua.
Thank you, Lily, so much.